Shrink Wrap Radio number 572, The Farther Reaches of Consciousness, with Ralph Metzner, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is psychotherapist Ralph Metzner, PhD. We'll be discussing two of his latest books, Overtones and Undercurrents and Ecology of Consciousness. For more information about Ralph Metzner, PhD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Ralph Metzner, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, yes.
Well, we spoke 3 years ago, back on episode number 386, in which you gave us an update on mind-expanding substances. And at that time, you shared your history as a student in clinical psychology at Harvard and your involvement with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, and who became Ram Dass. And just to share my own bona fides here, so you don't have to start back too far, throughout the mid-60s, I was a doctoral student in clinical psychology myself at the University of Michigan, and was strongly influenced by both Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, though I never met them in person. But they had a big impact on me nonetheless, and I did not drop out, but I did turn on and participate fully in the psychedelic revolution of that period. And so that's my background. You went on to publish more than 100 articles, as well as several books. You became a psychotherapist in private practice, a professor emeritus now at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and you became president and co-founder of the Green Earth Foundation. So being the very productive person that you are, you've just this year published two books, one titled Overtones and Undercurrents, Spirituality, Reincarnation, and Ancestor Influence in the Entheogenic Psychotherapy. And your second book of 2017 is The Ecology of Consciousness. So I've just said a lot. Let's start with your first book, Overtones.
Let me give the subtitle of the Ecology of Consciousness.
Yeah, good.
The Alchemy of Personal, Collective, and Planetary Transformation.
So, yes, and you can hold up your other book as well, so people can see it.
Yeah.
No, the other book, Overtones.
Overtones. You held that up.
Yeah, I have that one, but I just want the audience to see it as well. So these are both very high-quality paperback volumes. And so let's start with the first book, Overtones and Undercurrents, which is really a collection of psychotherapy case histories utilizing your own transpersonal approach. So what was the motivation of bringing out that particular book at this particular point in time?
Well, it's to illustrate, I mean, Jung and Freud both, you know, psychologists write case histories to illustrate their work and how it works, and other people do too, physicians and so on, to illustrate their work and to illustrate how people respond to them. Over 30, 40 years, I've developed methods of psychotherapy that you could be called transpersonal psychotherapy. I call it alchemical divination. And it's described with lots of examples in this book too, in The Ecology of Consciousness. But then this one is specifically some of the more interesting and unusual kind of case history of how people healed themselves or were healed through their practice, which involves the use of selective use of small amounts of psychoactive substances. Sometimes, not always. This is not a case book. It's not a case history of drug stories, for example. It's not what it is.
Right.
To me, the drugs that are used sometimes by me under circumstances when it's appropriate and legal to do so in this country or in other countries. I have taught a lot in Europe, and I've done workshops in I've done six week-long workshops every year for the past 10-20 years.
Wow.
Two in the United States, two in Sweden in English language, and two in Switzerland, which I teach in German because I was originally born German. And so I've accumulated a large number of stories. People write their stories about their experiences, and in the tradition of psychotherapy, then I use those. So, and my approach to psychotherapy is broader than the traditional one, and that's and one of the ways it's broader is that you look at traditional psychotherapy, you look at the relationship with mother and father and the Oedipus complex and all that kind of thing. But in a kind of, I call it multi-generational family systems therapy, the name of best name of the kind of work that I've done. Mm-hmm. It's multi-generational family systems therapy, where you track ancestral influences through at least two generations, so parental and then grandparents, parents of parents, and then two generations down, children and then children of children. And those factors are very much influenced by the work of a German family systems therapist who was also a priest originally, called Bert Hellinger. And one other aspect of the, when I say multi-dimensional, I mean the therapy includes the mental and the emotional and the sensory physical perceptions, of course, and then but also includes the recognition of connections that we have with the ancestors and with non-physical spiritual beings.
So, that's saying a lot of it right there. One of the things that you touch on briefly early on in the Overtones book is the distinction between psychosis and psychedelic states. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can say a little bit about how one distinguishes. I remember back in the day, it seems like one of the terms that was being used was psychotomimetic, or was it psychomimetic?
Psychotomimetic, yes.
Yeah, which was the notion that LSD and other substances would give a person an experience of what it was like to be a psychotic.
Right.
And I think the answer is kind of yes and no. So tell us about the distinctions.
And that was a psychiatric. One of the interesting things about these drugs that might be called psychedelics more generally is that there's really no agreement of what they should be called, you see. And that's one of the reasons. And there's a long list of drugs. The psychiatrists who first studied it looked at, because it when you expand consciousness, then it depends on what your consciousness is doing when it was, before it was expanded.
Uh-huh.
And if you have an appropriate set and setting for it. So in a psychotic state, there are profound changes in sense perception sometimes, but they happen, and the person has no idea why they happened, and are freaked out in a state of anxiety about them.
Yeah, that's a big difference between whether you've deliberately chosen to alter your conscious or suddenly you find yourself in a very strange state.
Right. Right, and very crucially, you have the knowledge that you took an actual drug that changed your perception, that you knew ahead of time. And I mean, you may not have understood how much it would change your perception, but the poor psychotics or schizophrenics, they don't have that. They don't have the knowledge that their perception, or they might have the knowledge that their perception is abnormal, but they don't realize that it's a temporary state. You see, you have to distinguish that's between what psychologists call states and traits. Like the state is a state of consciousness is time limited. It has a beginning, it lasts for a certain time, and then it has an end. You can return to the normal state. And that's very different than being a psychotic. The poor psychotic doesn't know he's in a temporary state and doesn't know when it's going to end.
Now, I use the word psychedelic, and throughout your books, you tend to use the word entheogen. So what is the distinction there for you?
Well, psychedelic means mind manifesting. That was a term suggested by psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond, and Aldous Huxley, the idea that what is sort of imagery that we have in our mind becomes very visibly and dramatically visualized out there. And that's an okay term. And over the years, I've sort of gravitated away from it because it has now accrued all kinds of sort of cultural associations. Mm-hmm. In fact, like, I remember at one time when my daughter was about 10 years old or 11 years old, she came rushing in and was looking at and saying, seeing some paisley patterns, and said, "Oh, look at that, psychedelic, woo-hoo." Uh-huh. Paisley patterns.
You know? Yeah, paisley patterns, yeah.
Psychedelic. Well, that's not what the psychedelic experience is about. You know, a person may see patterns, and visual patterns that in the initial stage of a LSD experience that look like paisley patterns, but that's not why the reason why people use these substances. They use them to expand consciousness and have some insight and understanding. I'm talking about the serious use, the intentional use, not the recreational use, of course. Then if you're just recreational use, then you might enjoy the paisley patterns or whatever and go dancing and all of that, you know. But that's a big difference that I make in this. You know, I'm only talking really about the intentional, structured, intentional use of these substances for healing oneself, self-understanding, healing, creativity, inspiration of creative insight and inventiveness in like that, and it's basically expanding consciousness.
Yeah, so, now, if psychedelic is mind-expanding, the word entheogen,
entheogen means connecting to the spiritual dimensions.
Okay.
Generating a spiritual experience, which is also not perfect. It's very difficult. That's part of the philosophical conundrum about these substances, is nobody can agree on what to call them. Everybody calls them something different from their point of view. The psychiatrists call them psychotomimetic, because what they do, they see psychosis all the time. And they see, like, what we would call bad trips. But the entheogenic is the idea that, well, it has the word theo in it, which is religious, spiritual. So the idea that somehow it generates it's a religious dimension, the spiritual dimension, rather, I should say. People think of it as a spiritual experience, not necessarily a religious, not necessarily Christian or Jewish, or like in a sense of the organized religion. But now it could, but then that's a whole area of research where religious professionals have also engaged these experiences and have tried to make sense of it. But I lean more towards not any of the religious perspectives, but more the shamanic, because the shamanic traditions, and I was very influenced by the anthropologist Michael Horner, who's written about the shamanic journey.
And he's in this area, too. He's lives in this same area that you and I do.
Yeah.
Northern California. Yeah.
And the shamanic journey experience has the same structure as a psychedelic experience. But the methods, they don't use the drugs. I mean, in some cultures, they do actually use drugs. But the primary method of propelling somebody on the journey is the rhythmic drumming.
Mm-hmm.
Which drives the brain waves. But it has that same structure. There's a threefold structure: preparing for the journey, becoming clear about what your intention is, then going on the journey, which is altered state, you know, where the people, the shaman would just have an assistant. He would beat the drum. And the shaman would lie down on the ground and close their eyes and pursue the journey inwardly. See, it's an inner journey, just like a psychedelic.
Yes.
And then the drumming stops, and like the drug wears off, and you come back, and then you focus on the after effects and the integration, like the question of, well, what does this mean for my life? Mm-hmm. What is it in terms of what my intention was? If my intention was to heal this person, let's say, or my intention was to heal my, or to increase my understanding of something, and then how did that do that? How do I interpret it? And you talk about it with the therapist or with whoever the guide was.
I've always been impressed or had the strong feeling that powerful altered states of consciousness can be used to facilitate dramatic change. And it sounds like that's a key part of your work.
Yes, they can be, but it's not so much. It's very hard to get across because it's not basically a drug effect. You know, you can't say you take this drug and you'll have a powerful expanded state of consciousness. That may or may not be so, depending on the set and setting. And nor is it necessarily true that the people who use it for positive spiritual and healing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Charlie Manson, for Pete's sake, used drugs like LSD to commit mayhem and murder. The CIA used it to brainwash prisoners of war, slipping it to them unaware, thereby violating all the ethical codes. The ethical codes are that you never change somebody else's consciousness against their will without their knowledge. Without their knowledge. It has to be conscious intention. Your conscious intention and agreement that you take this substance because it changes the way you look at reality.
Yeah.
It's an ethical violation. It's an ethical violation and totally to give somebody LSD without their knowledge or without a full explanation of what it's involved.
Well, I think your work over the past 30, 40 years has shown both a strong sense of ethical commitment and also a very scholarly approach. You know, people might think, well, this guy's taken a lot of drugs and some kind of nutcase running around with a lot of far out theories. But I found that reading the book Overtones, I was really struck with the combination, the rare combination of great openness to inner experience and a kind of scholarly control and presentation. So I think that's quite a trick to pull off. A few people have done it.
Well, thank you, but that's my role. So I'm an explorer of consciousness, and part of the explorer archetype is that you explore, whether it's, you know, the outer jungles in South America or it's the inner jungles of the mind, and then you report back to the community. That's the ethics of it. And I'm also a psychotherapist, so a healer. So, I've worked with using these substances in the context of healing as an adjunct and amplifier of psychotherapy, individual psychotherapy, and sometimes group psychotherapy. But also in the context of exploration and increasing knowledge, increasing creativity. Everything always depends on the intention and how does that process work and how does it work? The most difficult challenge in writing and communicating about these substances is that there are no other substances like that. I mean, you go to the doctor and you ask for a painkiller or an antibiotic. He gives you a painkiller or an antibiotic or narcotic if your pain is really severe. And then, you do it. You don't have to think about the set and the setting. You just say, take 3 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's it. Set and setting doesn't matter. You can't do that with these substances. You can only... Well, you have to have a special arrangement and with friends and with da-da-da-da like that. And it's confusing because then you think, well, the effects that I'm experiencing are drug effects. So therefore, and the religious professionals often did that. Well, what I'm experiencing, maybe I have a vision of God, but it's just a drug. After all, I just took a drug. So it's not valid.
So you don't write that off.
Well, then some people did, and there's a whole list of religious professionals. In our project, and when I was working with this group, I was working with Leary and Alpert during the '60s, the mid to late '60s, for a period of about 6 or 7 years, working very at Harvard and at Middlebrook. Later, very intensely with the three of us, but also like a larger group of 20 to 25 or more people, shifting cast of characters, doing sessions and sharing and communicating the knowledge, writing books, giving lectures, giving workshops, like that. And then all at the same time, in the culture, the availability of these drugs exploded.
Right. So, yes.
And that was not because we did it. We weren't drunk. We weren't pushing the drugs. People often said that we were pushing drugs on people. Not at all. I mean, and selling drugs to people. Not at all. It's totally untrue. We were like, we run these sessions at Millbrook. They involved no drugs. People not track drugs. And we said, but we'll show you. We'll do a workshop where you don't take drugs, where you learn how to do your own drug sessions.
Yeah. Because, one thing I found myself wondering was how you were able to get your degree without being tainted, by Alpert and Leary.
Well, no, that had nothing to do with it. In the 60s, I got my degree in 1963.
Okay, so you got had your degree early on.
62. I was a graduate student, fourth-year graduate student. Leary and Alpert were two of my professors.
Okay. I didn't get my degree till 70, so later.
I had a postdoctoral fellowship in psychopharmacology from the National Institute of Mental Health, which meant I'd studied the two-year pharmacology course that all medical students take because I wanted to know more about the technical information about these drugs, which were completely unknown to me. Yeah. You kind of realize that in the early 60s, you know, LSD didn't mean anything. You could have said XYZ or IBM. It didn't mean anything. It was just three letters.
Right.
Nowadays, you can't say that. You can't say LSD, and people say, oh, my God, drugs, danger, kill, murder, madness. That's why I prefer a term like entheogenic, because then you have to kind of the main reason I like it, because it brings the spiritual dimensions and makes it central.
Yeah. Now, in your explorations and journeying and so on, one of the ideas that you've embraced is reincarnation.
Yes.
I haven't been able to go quite that far. So I'm wondering what experiences have you had that persuade you of? Your book is really all about things that fall beyond what conventional science and psychology is willing to accept these days.
Right.
What is it that persuades you about reincarnation?
Well, people who've worked with psychotherapists, actually, who have worked with psychedelics, and physicians who've also worked with hypnotic regression, for example, work with hypnotic regressions. Just forget about psychedelics for a moment. Just people in regular kind of psychotherapy, and then sometimes doing guided imagery work, would sometimes report that people started reporting their visions from another lifetime. And there's a whole field of reincarnational guided psychotherapy where people are going to sort of a light hypnotic trance state and find themselves in another lifetime and find themselves that, and this is the approach that I use, these stories emerge just like in an expanded state or in the course of psychotherapy. People might find, well, okay, so the origin of this problem is in childhood. You know, and Freud and the others, they say, well, early childhood, the Oedipus complex and all of that. And then some psychotherapists went further and said, like Stan Grof, my colleague and friend, and he said, and others, you know, you have to go further. And Otto Rank was another one. You have to go further to the birth experience. And so the parent, what they call the perinatal experience, and the experience around birth can leave a profound, the idea of the birth trauma can leave a profound effect on lifetime-long issues, which in regular psychotherapy doesn't recognize, you see. And there's only a group of specialists who have kind of embraced that approach and have their own professional associations and books and journals. And so, and then some go even further, but not only around birth, but then also around the whole intrauterine experience and around conception. So the conclusions that I've come to as a result of the work that I've been doing is that before birth, there are three lines of influence that come into us and help determine, not control, but determine, help shape the kind of life we lead. One is the before birth now, so including conception, for example. One is the ancestral line through the father, right? Father line comes into our being at the moment of conception, because we have DNA of the father. And then the mother line, and all that the mother and the father represents, their own genetics, their own psychological patterns, their own family patterns, their own karma, whatever, that's all plugged in, so to speak, pre-programmed at the time of conception, and then, of course, amplified during the prenatal period, and then, of course, amplified after, during early childhood, as we know. And then the third line is other lifetimes. So that's not family, it's not ancestral, and it's not psychological, and it's not this life.
And I know I've read books from, you know, some time back where that gave case reports of people who had rather intransigent symptoms that they were not receiving any relief from conventional approaches, and then they experience a past life regression, and the symptoms immediately lift, and they experience a dramatic relief. So I know those accounts have been out there for some time.
They're very convincing to the person who has them. They're totally unconvincing to the observer outside, especially the traditional medical and traditional psychological academic establishment, which regards incarnation as a fanciful way out theory, which for which we have no evidence, which is flies in the face of reincarnation and many lifetimes, is actually the basic belief system of virtually all religions, Eastern and Western, including Buddhism, Hinduism, and early Christianity, and was part of Christianity as well, until about the 4th century when the Catholic Church nixed it out. Jesus talks about his past lifetimes in the New Testament.
Well, he's Jesus. He can do that.
I've gone a lot into the history of the church and so forth. In the fourth century, the church was establishing its power, and it controlled what could be believed, what could be stated. Mm-hmm. Power was absolute, and they decided that there are only after you die, there are only three possible options for you. One of them is hell, and everybody knows how bad that is, and we'll remind you. It's paradise, and paradise is pretty great, but you have to be really like a saint to get there. It's pretty hard. And most likely is purgatory, where you suffer for your sins for a certain amount of time. And this was the way I see it. And many others too. So then there's no talk about reincarnation. See, there's no attention paid to reincarnation at all.
I didn't know that reincarnation had been a part of early Christianity. So that's news to me.
Jesus Christ talks about it. It's in the New Testament. But the denial or non-acceptance of reincarnation has profound ethical consequences. Because when you think about it, if you think, well, after you die, basically that's it, nothing happens, what does that do to your responsibility for your actions? You see, I can just fool around, I can kill people, I can do murder and mayhem. It doesn't matter, because when it's over, it's over. So fuck you, basically. That's kind of the attitude.
And unless you think you're going to go to hell. I mean, that's the other...
But if you don't believe that whole thing, and the official worldview doesn't believe it, and Christianity didn't believe it, because Christianity wanted people to pray and to pay to the church and get indulgences so you could buy indulgences. That was Martin Luther's complaint. He says, you can't pay off in advance for sins. He thought that was absurd and ethically, criminal, which it is.
Thinking about reincarnation raised a weird question in my mind that I've never asked anybody about before. But, you know, sometimes people say, oh, well, be careful about doing such and such. You might get reincarnated as a bug. In your view, as far as you know, always get reincarnated as human beings, or do they get reincarnated sometimes as animals?
No. Maybe animal-like people. But, you know, that happens in everyday life.
Yeah.
Now people behave in a brutish manner. Behave like animals.
I wanted to touch on another area in your book, since all of the cases have some sort of component of something that stretches ordinary credulity. I was particularly interested. You were sitting at Mendocino State Hospital and listening to a woman who was acutely psychotic at the time. And you notice that her thoughts, that there seemed to be a telepathic component, because you notice that in the word salad, as she was babbling, that some of her babbling actually reflected things that you were thinking about.
Right.
Have you had other experiences?
It's a view of psychotic states. Psychosis is an altered state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. In which your perception, your feeling, the way you're thinking and everything is profoundly different from the ordinary realm. And one of the things is that your sense perception, just like with psychedelic drugs, your sense perception enhances. So you become more acutely aware of sounds and more acutely aware of vision and sense. But mostly in psychotic states, once you're given a antipsychotic drug, then those things are blunted out. But you're having this flood of ideas. So there's a release of the normally, you know, the ideas and the thoughts and the images in our minds are screened out for functioning. You know, because screening out a lot, because you and I want to talk here about this thing, and I'm screening out. I'm not taking in the sunlight and the through the window. I could, but I'm not doing that because my intention is focused on what we're doing.
Yeah.
In psychotic people or schizophrenic people, for somehow they lose the ability to direct your attention consciously, and it's being sort of captured and seized. And there may be like heightened sensation. So the paranoid people may hear people talking, and he can't quite make up what what they're saying, but he feels terrible. So he thinks that maybe they're talking about bad thing about me, and that's why I feel terrible. And then he goes on that. Or maybe the food tastes funny because the senses have been heightened. And then maybe it tastes funny. That's what's making me feel so weird, because somebody put some negative stuff in my food. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically a kind of a paranoid thing. My experience has changed, so somebody did it for me, because I feel bad.
It's the opposite.
It's the opposite of a psychedelic experience, but it has the heightened sensation.
So I know there's considerable evidence, if one accepts any idea of telepathy, that is more likely to happen in an altered state of consciousness. And so, I gather it's not surprising to you that that would happen when someone's psychotic. And I know my own experience of being with psychotic people is you can really lose your boundaries. You know, they're in a kind of boundaryless state themselves, and unless you are clinging tightly to your identity, you can find yourself being drawn into that.
Right, because they're often very perceptive, and they can zero in on your weird stuff that you've got going. But the usual psychiatric or psychotherapy intervention is stated in such a way that that you're not allowed to do that. You don't do that. Anyway, they'll quickly give you a drug before you go too far in that dimension. And then you can talk it over with your supervisor, you know.
Yeah.
But And when I told that story, I just wanted to mention that because I didn't have that agenda. I was not on the staff of the hospital. I didn't have to decide whether she was going to be hospitalized or not. You know, I didn't have to make that decision. That was being made by the psychiatrist in charge. So I was just like listening to her and trying to empathically trying to get a sense. My approach has always been empathic, understanding, and distinguish the way from empathy from sympathy by the fact that it's a conscious, intentional, like putting yourself in the other person's shoes, but maintaining your own balance as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So experiencing something of what the other person experiences, but maintaining your own sense of balance. Now, distinguish like sympathy. Sympathy is a kind of instinctive reactions. You know, if you feel sad, then I'll feel sad, and then we can both have a nice cry together. But it doesn't really solve anything. It's nice. Misery loves company. It feels better to be with somebody than to be alone. It doesn't really solve a problem. But if you turn it into empathy, and that's what the Buddhist teaching, which is the Buddhist term for that, is compassion. And so they say you want to balance the wisdom, which is the insight, and the compassion. Because the insight by itself, vision, can be kind of cold and detached. Yeah, I see what your problem is. You're a psychotic. Here's the problem. That's it. Go away.
Yeah.
Or you can have too much compassion and too much empathy or sympathy, I would say, unconscious sympathy. It's like the analogy if you're going down the street and there's a hole in the ground and there's a guy in the hole, 10 foot down, and you come to the hole and like with a sympathy reaction, you jump down into the hole. And then you've got two people in the hall. And they can keep each other company, which is better than being alone. But the empathy would say, or person would say with empathy, would say, oh, you're in the hall. Let me get a ladder.
Yeah, yeah.
One
of the other sort of farther out cases deals with demon possession. And that particularly catches my interest because I was raised partly by my grandparents, who were evangelical Christians. They would be called holy rollers. Yeah. And they believed very much in demonic possession, and part of what they did was to cast out demons.
Uh-huh.
So maybe you can give us the highlights of that particular case.
Well, there is a somewhat specialized field within psychiatry, psychology. Many professionals don't go anywhere near it, but the vast majority of possession, you think of possession as an extreme of obsession. You know, when you're obsessed with an idea or with a person, you can be obsessed with an idea or with a project or a person. It's like your attention and your consciousness is narrowly focused on that person. and what you want to do and the kind of interaction you want to have. And then but you still kind of respect the other person as an individual. And then possession possessiveness is a trait. It's a trait of normal, you know, we think about the over-possessive mother or over-possessive parent, for example, or husband or wife, you know, who wants to control everything that the spouse does or that the child does or even thinks, you know, don't think that way, da-da-da. And especially if the child, for example, has an illness and is reduced in their own ability to take care of themselves, and I'll take care of you and like that. So possessiveness is this kind of a spectrum of obsession, possession, and possession is like... And traditionally, then once you, the over-possessive grandmother, the over-possessive mother, this is something we know, actually, in our everyday life.
But there are sort of two possibilities here. I'm sure many more than two, but the conventional view would be that it's a disowned, a split-off aspect of oneself, some unconscious aspect that is experienced as out there and being possessive. The other view is of it being a discarnate, demonic entity outside of oneself.
Right.
And so, where do you come down on that? I mean, it sounds like you've, and that raises the whole question of evil and the nature of evil.
From my experience, the vast majority of possession states are possessions by a family member, and the family member may be dead, you see. So then it becomes kind of weirdly spiritual. In other words, if a child or a young person is very influenced by their grandmother or their grandparents, and then that parent dies and the child grows up and but stays until, see, then what kind of a worldview do you have? And it's still like responding to and there's evidence that from other cultures, and one theory, one view, I'm not saying that this is necessarily the way it works, is that some people, when they die, they who have not accepted the fact that they're dead.
I've heard that, yes.
If they die suddenly, for example, or they don't have a belief system that they can that something of them remains after death, and so they're still clinging to what they had in the lifetime and clinging to an influence that they had, wanting to possess a child, for example, like that. Now, so I think from my experience and from the reading of the literature too, the vast majority of so-called obsession states are states by possession by an acquaintance, a family member acquaintance. There is a small percentage of people where there's some kind of demonic or spirit possession, in other words, non-human kind of thing. And then one of the stories in the book is like that. Now, in other cultures, recognize this, like Brazil, for example, possession states is considered normal, you know, I mean, on the spectrum of normality. But that's a cultural, there's a cultural openness to working with that. And there are methods that they develop for depossessing. There are therapists who have worked with that, and I have too, that are methods of how do you depossess somebody. I described in the book who's, you know, been possessed.
And you reminded me of growing up in that holy roller environment that I did, that there is the seeking of being filled by the Spirit, by the Holy Spirit, which I never thought about that in terms of possession, but you're kind of linking it to the, you know, to voodoo and the Caribbean religions, where they would seek out that ecstatic state of of being possessed.
Right. Yeah. And see, to me, I go with those people who say, and including some of the traditional teachers in other cultures who work in this field, who work you might say, a controlled possession trance, like inspiration is like that. And like in a controlled intentional way, tuning into an ancestral spirit, for example. So a shaman, for example, might have an elder or a parent, father or mother or grandparent or father who was very their spiritual guide and remains their spiritual guide after they died. And so I've been in Native American ceremonies where the people will say, "No, I'm tuning into grandfather and my great grandfather, but also, you know, he's still alive." And then the grandfather who passed, and these are the people that I tune into. And then they may tune into spirits of the culture that we would. And then that gets into what we would call deities, the deities, the protective deities of a whole tribe or a whole culture. So then Christians would say, "Well, when Jesus said himself, when two or more are gathered in my name, I will be there." That's in the Bible, right? When two or three are gathered in my name, I will be there. You call the name. The way you connect with ancestors, you call their name. It's called an invocation. And the holy rollers, they do the same thing. Or the Baptists who, you know, praise the Lord and they feel the spirit of the Lord within them. So this is a whole spectrum of the degree to which you let yourself be not controlled, but let yourself express and channel. To my mind, the more interesting experiences and more worthwhile in the long range are the ones where there's always some degree you maintain some connection with the here now, and you work with that difference between what is the spirit telling you and what are you, what can you use, what you can you channel, how can you apply it in healing, your own healing, healing of others, your art, whatever it may be.
Yeah. That sounds like a good integration of a Western mode and, you know, and the shamanic mode. Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about your other book, which unfortunately somebody was supposed to send me a copy, and the time was too short, and so I didn't get the copy. I was browsing a little bit on Amazon. They let you leaf through the book a little bit, which was nice. And one idea that stuck out for me was that you were talking about hierarchy, and then you talked about holyarchy or holarchy. Right. Yeah, and I haven't ever encountered that word before. There must be a whole lot that you have to say around that.
Right, right. Well, a hierarchy is a model of power and information, power and knowledge flow. It's a one-way flow of power and knowledge. For example, there's a hierarchy involved in the Catholic Church, in the church. You know, there's a pope at the top of the hierarchy, and then there's bishops and archbishops, and then there's priests, and each one of them has the idea is like has more of the spiritual power and the spiritual authority. And so there's a focus of spiritual power and authority that flows down to the parishioners and the parish priests, and then eventually to the people in their ceremonies. And then there are the military, for example, is a prime example of a hierarchical structure, and it's necessary. You know, you want to have command, control, and communication. That's the way the CCC, that's the language they always use. You know, the general, and then the colonel, and then the lieutenant, and all the way down to the sergeant, down to the grunt. Information and control goes one way only.
Yeah.
And no questioning. You know, yes, right. Sir. I don't understand why you're telling me to wash the toilet, but I'll do it. Yes, sir.
Right.
And you can see where the military likes that, and they want that, because if you're in a fight, you want the general to be able to issue orders and have the people actually do that.
Yeah, yeah. And government, too, is mostly organized that way. And businesses, the government and corporations.
Exactly. What I was often wondered about, why do the leaders of corporations, they're called chief executive officer. I mean, think of that. That's a military language, right?
Yeah, officer? Right, it is.
Executive, I always think about execution. It's somehow it's the same word as execution. Go execute, and people are getting, you know, in the discussions in the business world, it's very interesting, because people are now, like women, for example, are saying, well, wait a minute, you can't order me around like somebody. You know, I'm not being treated as a woman. I'm not being treated as a human being with respect. You can't do that. This is a very live issue. The business culture is very militaristic and very hierarchical. You know,
I never thought about the language. You know, like exec, and people are besides. They get a raise based upon their ability to execute.
Yeah.
Right.
Operating officers. You know, move people around. Yeah, go fire these people. Go fire these people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't think of it as a model. But there are other ways to organize a business.
Well, tell us about holarchy. What is a holarchy? A
holarchy is natural. Its nature is holarchical. It's holes with parts within holes, and each a whole system that has parts. And that whole system is itself a part of a larger whole system. Take the human body. The human body has these different organs, the liver, the brain, the heart, and so forth. It's a holarchy. It's not a hierarchy. None of the organs gives orders to the other organs to function. They function in a communication way, two-way flow of communication. Integration, harmonization, balancing, integration, like that. In fact, if one part tries to give orders to another part, that's often what we call psychosomatic illness. That somebody is like head dominant. The head is constantly trying to control, tell the heart what to do and what to feel. Mm-hmm. And the heart says, well, no, you know, I don't really feel like doing that. So Or the sexual organs, for example, might have their own, you know, agenda that's quite independent of what the person thinks and wants. That's notoriously so. So the body is a holarchy. Now, then from that, it goes up because the individual is a part of a family. The family is not a hierarchy. It's not. Some families might try to be like a hierarchy. It's a holarchy where each person is recognized as has their particular role. The mother role, the father role, the brothers, the sisters, like that. They have their role and they work with each other and it's interactive. And then the family might be part of a larger community. And the community might be the village. And they also, each family has its, you know, respects its own and then the community. So the family and the community, and that's just the human. And then the society, and then, let's say, the nation state, and then the whole civilization of a culture. Now, you can also go the holarchy in the other direction. So because each of the organs is an assembly of hundreds of thousands of cells. That's not a hierarchy. They don't issue orders to the cells, as we know. All biochemistry and, you know, gives us detailed the levels of the sciences study at each level, at the physiological level, at the biochemical level, then at the cellular level. The cells are part of clusters of cells, and the cell itself is a holarchical organization, has the different parts. And then down to molecules. Molecules are configurations of elements, of atoms, that have their own science, the whole molecular chemistry and atomic physics. And then even the atom is not an individual idea. People used to think you can reduce everything to atoms. Well, it's absurd. You can't reduce everything to atoms. First of all, it's not fundamental. There's subatomic particles, like quarks and weird particles that sort of disappear and you can't really see them and they're not really there. They're only like probability waves. And meantime, we're living and we're doing all this stuff. We're not dependent on that system, understanding that system in order to function. So at each level, the system functions at each level independently but connected with the levels above and the levels below.
Yeah, and also one of the things that I'm increasingly interested in is that the boundaries are not nearly so sharp as we tend to think.
Exactly.
We think our skin is the boundary of what I call me, and now there's all this information about the biome, these sort of what we would call the despised otherness of our of our colon, right? And there are all these organisms in there that are crucial to our well-being.
Well, exactly. Yeah, microbes and bacteria.
Absolutely. And we have the symbiotic relationship with them. And are they inside or outside? Or, you know, it's all
right. Yeah, and our bodies are miraculously and beautifully evolved with the communication back and forth between the different levels, between the organs and the cells, and the cell between the microbes and in the environment. And, you know, they have the whole defense system, so they can, cells can distinguish between microbes that are beneficial and serve as nourishment and those that are maybe threatening and dangerous. Because if they didn't, then we wouldn't have survived, you see. Mm-hmm. Survival depends on having a system way of working and also defending yourself and dealing with threats from the environment. And we're totally dependent on the friendly bacteria and the immune system which has many different aspects, defends the integrity of the organism in the environment in which we. In which we are raised, and then if we move to a different environment or the environment changes, then we get all these classical, what we call the diseases of civilization or the diseases that are dependent on So the idea of the hierarchy is sort of intuitively correct. We know it's correct, but we function with it in the sciences. But in our sciences, people tend to focus just on the one that they know best. And they say, well, I don't know about that other stuff. But that's one of the things that happens with expanded consciousness, including the experiences with psychedelics, is that you can no longer maintain that focus. And that's why people have documented and written, for example, Jeremy Narby wrote about when he gave ayahuasca to biochemists and physicists and biologists and so forth, who then had the opportunity to understand certain issues in their science, their scientific specialty, that they hadn't been able to understand before by looking at it from the subjective point of view, by the consciousness of the cells and the microbes.
I wasn't aware of that work. Pulling back a bit, we seem to be living in distressful times right now. There's a lot of distress all over the planet. You and I have just gone through the Northern California wildfires that were very threatening. Fortunately, we both came through so far. What's your view? I know you must have a view on the meaning of this period that we're in, and what, I guess, you know, what distresses you and what sustains you? Just a little question.
That's all you want, right?
Yeah, that's all.
The big picture, I don't know.
Do you have any sense of hope, or are you experiencing despair, or some mix of the two?
Yeah, let me think for a moment. We're in a range beyond struggling about hope, you know, because just do what is needed to do, what you see in front of you, what's needed to do. And don't get caught up in hope and hopelessness. And there's always hope. There's always possibility for change that can be unanticipated. You know, your house may burn down, but maybe not. The common sense motto is like, prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
And also, if your house burns down, some people.
Yes.
Along with that, experience a lightning. I heard one person who spoke on television who said, or maybe it was a personal being said from one person to another, that, okay, well, now we don't have to move all that stuff. We were downsizing. We were planning to downsize. Yeah. And now that's kind of been taken care of for us. And we don't have to worry about packing up and moving it all and deciding what we want to keep and what we don't. That's a very positive response.
Well, absolutely.
Alongside, I'm sure, some sense of loss and grief, but it's possible to have both.
Right, absolutely. Acknowledging the grief, acknowledge the reality of loss, and you acknowledge the reality of loss and loss of life and loss of connection with people and animals and all of that, destruction. And then you do what you can, what is given to you, what your own. Each of us has certain inner gifts, and you have inner guidance. Your own inner guidance, your own inner guiding spirit, will tell you and guide you to where you can make a contribution. And maybe your contribution is to go and cook some meals for some people who are very hungry. Or maybe the contribution you can do is go and deliver some more clothes to people who need clothes. And people are doing that. It's a catastrophe like these fires. It brings out really the best in people. It brings out the worst in some small percentage of the people, but brings out the best in people, like that guy who saved 1,000 horses or 1,000 animals on his property, on his own kind of private wild animal preserve. And didn't evacuate and just went around and put out the brush fires on his wild animal preserve. You read that story, I'm sure.
Yes, right. So
that what he was given to do. He said, well, I brought these animals here. I can't just leave them because, you know, out of my own fear and so on. I brought them here, so I have a sense of responsibility to them. So he did what he could, and he saved them.
We saw many people who really value their pets and their animals and went to extraordinary lengths to make sure that their animals were okay.
Exactly. When you leave, you have to abandon your house. You take all the people and the pets, all the living things, and the material things that you absolutely need, you know, if you have the time. But it's a good practice, not that you won't recommend it to anybody, but it's a good practice to have a list for in your mind, at least, of what things you would not want to leave behind, like your passport or some extra money or, you know, some of the basic medicines, your medications, and all that kind of stuff.
I think something you just said really encapsulates a lot of your work and a lot of the writing that I read, which is that you're very interested in, that you have a profound belief in people's inner guidance, that there is an inner guidance there for them if they'll take the time and use the tools that are available to them to go within and to take from whatever wisdom is there and then figure out how to bring it back and apply it to the current situation.
Yes, because we have free will. You know, as human beings, we have free will and choice. We may be guided and influenced by all kinds of factors, but we always have the choice. And if we're in a stressful situation, we have the choice, am I just going to freak out and stress out and maybe go get drunk or whatever? Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but not very helpful necessarily. Or am I going to contribute to conflict and disorder, or am I going to do what I can to contribute to helping people and helping others, be more safe and be more creative and expand their own expression of their own potentials? After all, what are we here for? You know, we'll all come to the end of our life eventually, and some of us sooner than others. And that's the oldest wisdom of the earth, you know, be prepared to leave, because you might leave any time. I like very much, you know, the traditional teaching is like one traditional teaching, and Socrates was said to have said this, and live every day as if it was going to be your last day, because it could be. Now, it doesn't mean you have to sorrow and grieve, not at all, quite the contrary. Uh-huh. But don't waste your time on, like, unimportant trivialities or arguments or, you know, or amassing more wealth or whatever.
You know, that's a great reminder, Ralph, and I think maybe that's a great statement for us to wrap this up.
Yes, live every day as if it's your last.
Yeah, so Ralph Metzner, I want to thank you so much for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for inviting me. Absolutely. I enjoyed talking with you.
You may have noticed that my voice sounds different on this interview. I believe it's a result of all the smoke I've inhaled during the recent week-long firestorm in our area. Many people perished and thousands of homes and businesses were destroyed. Many people are still in emergency shelters. Thankfully, our home was untouched. Two of our children and their children live within a mile or two of us, and thankfully they are safe as well. Last night, we had a minor magnitude 2 earthquake just a couple of miles from here. Do we really need this too? We're keeping our fingers crossed that that long-predicted big one is not on its way. As it happens, today's guest, Ralph Metzner, lives in another part of Sonoma County and had to evacuate to a friend's house twice. But his property was also spared from the destruction. So we have multiple counts for gratitude that we are able to go ahead with the interview. However, there were still challenges to overcome. We spent about 15 minutes trying to get the audio for the video using Zoom and finally had to switch to Skype. However, on Skype, I was unable to see myself to make sure I was in the frame. And that's why you will notice that I'm only partially in the frame on the video. Phew! I'm just glad to be able to get this podcast out to you. I'm very impressed by Ralph's resilience and persistence as one of the early pioneers of the psychedelic movement. He's definitely hung in there for the long haul, diligently continuing his own explorations, creating maps of consciousness for us to follow, and sharing his work with other intrepid explorers. I think we're in the midst of a second psychedelic renaissance, this one, hopefully, with less spectacle. All over the world, we have people with solid scientific credentials exploring the healing potential of various entheogens, to use Ralph's term, especially when used in a therapeutic context with proper attention to the power of set and setting. Things like reincarnation, past lives, demon possession, and so on are still a bit of a stretch for me. As Ralph noted, if you've experienced them, you're a believer. If you haven't experienced them, you're more likely to be a skeptic, depending upon your ability to accept the reports of others. As Ralph points out, there's also a long history of peoples all over the world reporting their own experiences with these phenomena over the stretch of time. For myself, the truth of how these approaches actually work is not as important as the fact that they provide healing for some, regardless of what the mechanism of their effectiveness is. At one level, does it really matter whether one is actually getting guidance from a dead relative or whether from their own unconscious? Ralph Metzner is not a wild-eyed drug fanatic. Instead, he is a meticulous scholar and an intrepid explorer. If you are at all open to these farther reaches of consciousness or curious about them, I encourage you to check out Dr. Ralph Metzner's writings. If you decide to purchase either Overtones and Undercurrents or Ecology of Consciousness or both by Ralph Metzner, PhD, I hope you'll use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com to do so. If you'd like to participate in one of the workshops that Dr. Metzner described, you might want to check out his website at www.greenearthfound.org. That's greenearthfound.org. In other words, foundation is not fully spelled out. In addition, you might want to listen or re-listen to my interview with him from 3 years ago on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 386 about mind-expanding substances.
Hello, fellow Shrink Wrappers. I have a couple of questions for you. Do you think that Dave is doing a good job? Well, I do anyway. And do you wish for him to continue producing these podcasts? I sure do. So, are you willing to support him? I just did. It's easy. Go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Click Support on the top menu. Select the amount you wish to contribute. If you have a PayPal account, enter your credentials. If you don't have a PayPal account, you can still do one-time donations by just entering your credit card details. PayPal will take care of the rest. David will be happy, and we will all get the benefit of his excellent guests and his well-honed interview skills. Now to my last question. When will you do it?
I'm hoping your answer to Sven's question is now. If you're not already a financial supporter for Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Sven by going to our website and clicking on the big support button in the right-hand sidebar. You will feel so glad that you did, and as Sven points out, so will I. I want to give an unpaid plug to a worthy cause here. It's called the You Matter Marathon, but no running is required. The You Matter Marathon is creating and enriching positive connections between people and within communities. Last November, people from all 50 states and 59 countries shared 431,460 You Matter cards. This year, they're determined to share 1 million You Matter cards. The results are astounding. 61% of participants report that they achieve a greater sense of gratitude and enhanced connection with others. 51% report enhanced compassion for others, and 50% achieve enhanced levels of personal happiness. The lesson: one small gesture and two small words can help forge connections and spread kindness, compassion, and happiness. Now, this was started by a psychologist and motivational coach named Cheryl Rice, PhD. And she has created business-sized cards that say, "You Matter," on them. And she hands them out to people who she feels like maybe could use a little recognition. They might be a grocer. They might be somebody that she encounters on the street. And so this is a wonderful sort of positive initiative. So this global initiative, founded by Cheryl Rice, encourages positive connections between individuals and communities. And during November, individuals share these business-sized cards with only the words, "You Matter," on them. So if you or your organization is looking for a powerful way to build community and make a meaningful difference, consider participating in the You Matter Marathon. Now, there's a video on YouTube that illustrates this very dramatically, and you'll probably find a link to it at www.youmattermarathon.com, where you can get all the information about this program. And you, if you sign up, you will receive 30 pre-printed You Matter cards in the mail free, and you can join the Facebook card to connect with other You Matter marathoners and participants and to share progress and inspiring stories. To sign up, just go to www.youmattermarathon.com and get your free 30 You Matter cards while supplies last. By the way, this doesn't have to be restricted to November. So whenever you hear this message, this podcast, send off for your You Matter cards and just go ahead and distribute them. As you know, I do a lot of my reading with my ears, and Audible.com for years has been my source of great listening material. Well, I've got a great Audible suggestion to accompany today's interview. It's The Psychedelic Experience, a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it's by Timothy Leary, Ralph Metzner, and Richard Alpert. It's unabridged and 4 hours and 39 minutes in length. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep, and with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if this one's not to your taste, they've got more than 250,000 titles for you to choose from. With that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave your voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Ralph Metzner, for sharing his explorations on the farther reaches of consciousness. My next guest will be Tony Caldwell, a Jungian-oriented therapist and social work educator at the University of Mississippi, who also leads racial healing workshops throughout Mississippi. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.